We'll start as we always do with our look at what's in today's Sunday newspapers. My panel in studio to help me go through them this morning: Sheila Riley, head of digital at Iconic News and former editor of the Longford Leader. Good morning, Sheila.
Good morning, Gavin.
John O'Brien is professor of European politics at NUI Maynooth, rather Maynooth University these days, isn't it, John? Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Sorry for the slightly old branding. And making his on the record debut this morning, Paul O'Brien, head of public affairs at Drury and former government advisor. Good morning to you, Paul.
Good morning, Gavin.
And welcome aboard. Let's have a quick look at what's on the front pages of the Sunday newspapers. We'll start with the Sunday Times. Loyalists plot action if Boris shafts the North, is the headline over a piece by John Mooney. Loyalist paramilitary organisations and their supporters are predicting protests and campaigns of civil disobedience if the British government attempts to align Northern Ireland and the Republic in any customs arrangement as part of a Brexit compromise. Sources within the Ulster Volunteer Force, or UVF, in East Belfast, saying that it's planning to organise demonstrations and protests using proxies if Boris Johnson's government does anything which its members believe dilutes the status of Northern Ireland within the UK. The Ulster Defence Association in West Belfast is adopting a wait-and-see approach until the specifics of any Brexit deal are announced, according to sources close to the group's thinking, but it is making contingency plans. Also on the front page as well, Varadkar urged to cash in on Brexit deal with a snap election. Justine McCarthy tells us that the Taoiseach is coming under pressure from some Fine Gael ministers to call a snap general election if there is a Brexit deal agreed before Halloween. Younger cabinet ministers, including Owen Murphy and Simon Harris, have told colleagues they believe Leo Varadkar should go to the country now, while his intervention is seen as having broken the deadlock in the three-year negotiations. And also, as a sidebar in the Sunday Times, students told to leave so that President Higgins can sell a house. The tenants of a Galway property owned by President Michael D. Higgins have been told to move out because the house has been put on the market. Higgins and his wife Sabina will benefit from an enhanced tax break by selling the house within 7 years of its purchase. The President has previously been a critic of property speculators, and during last year's election campaign he also backed calls by Dr. Peter McVerry for a 3-year moratorium on evictions. So that's the front page of the Sunday Times. The Sunday Business Post has reminded us that there was in fact a budget 5 days ago, which appears to have largely disappeared. Awful lot of the newsprint today. Years of budget surpluses needed to offset corporation tax shock, tells us Michael Brennan. Pascal Donoghue has warned that the state will need to run several years of large budget surpluses to guard against a sudden collapse in corporation tax. Donoghue's comments were made after the OECD announced plans to force tech companies like Google and Facebook to pay more taxes in the countries where they make their biggest sales, which could lose the state €1 billion a year. Department of Finance analysis has warned of a €6 billion drop in corporation tax revenues if they go back to their 2014 level, which I suppose might be why the Fiscal Advisory Council has been warning us for so long not to get too reliant on all of this corporate tax income. Also in the Sunday Business Post, social media giants fail to act on requests to move hate speech. Aaron Rogan tells us that Facebook and Twitter did not act on calls from members of an anti-racism partner organisation to remove comments inciting violence and hatred against minorities in Ireland, a Sunday Business Post investigation has found. The companies are among the social media firms who signed up to the European Commission's Code of Conduct to counter the spread of hate speech online, and they've agreed to be monitored by independent groups, including the Irish chapter of the European Network Against Racism. But as part of an investigation with the Business Post, ENR staff used their personal accounts to flag comments in breach of the code, which resulted in only 24%, 11 out of 45, of the comments actually being removed. So clearly people not quite up to their word there. Sunday Independent, battle to protect new Brexit deal. Maybe things are not quite as rosy as they're suspecting. The government has moved to protect the proposed compromise Brexit deal after a twin attack by a hardline Brexiteer and the deputy leader of the DUP. The British and Irish government's plans to address the impasse suffered an apparent setback after the DUP's Nigel Dodds said the double customs solution cannot work, and Brexiteer Owen Paterson, a former Northern Ireland secretary, suggested that it would ride roughshod over the Good Friday Agreement. Last night, government sources in Dublin said the comments by Mr Dodds, the DUP leader in Westminster, should not be overblown, adding he's only looking for political cover. Also on the front page there, the chief executive of AIB is calling for the central bank rules on mortgage lending to be slightly relaxed. And finally for now, the front page of the Irish Mail on Sunday. Boris and Leo, it's a Brexit bromance. Well, as if we hadn't guessed from their lovely walks through the lovely Cheshire leafy woods on Thursday. Taoiseach Leo Varadkar and Boris Johnson, Prime Minister, joked about the war of words between WAG's Colleen Rooney and Rebecca Vardy in a display of bonhomie that surprised even their closest advisers. I don't know whether close advisers will be all that shocked. The breakthrough at this week's summit in Merseyside's Thornton Manor was clear to see when the pair emerged smiling from a 90-minute meeting behind closed doors, sources have revealed. The remarkable inside details of the war meeting come between the two premiers. Comes as the Irish Mail on Sunday can also reveal that Irish negotiators believe that despite protesting otherwise, the DUP will eventually go along with the emerging Brexit deal, and that Mr. Bradker's Brexit advisers dismiss comparisons of Boris Johnson to the controversial US President Donald Trump. Brexit, the budget and the War of the Wags all covered on the front pages of this morning's papers. Our panel again in studio, Sheila Riley, John O'Brien and Paul O'Brien. John, I'll come to you first of all. What do you make of the DUP's caginess as regards what's coming out in Brexit and the fact that indeed after so much pessimism for so long that we now finally look like there may be the bones of a deal being plucked from the jaws of defeat at the last minute?
Well, we may, but I'm not so sure about that. It was a pretty depressing week.
The hope lasted for about 15 seconds there. Thanks for that.
It was a very depressing week up until Thursday. Lots of unattributed briefing from Downing Street, which everybody seems to know the source for. And then suddenly the mood music changed on Thursday. Mm. So that allowed the EU to go into the tunnel, as they term it. That simply means an intensified sort of mode of negotiation. So we simply don't know. This is going to be a very dramatic week because we have the European Council meeting on Thursday. The House of Commons is sitting for a special session on Saturday in the hope of ratifying what comes back.
And if it doesn't ratify, we don't exactly know what it is that they're going to be doing.
That's true. Mm. I mean, if I were the DUP, I would be very worried. Because it looks very much like a Northern Ireland specific backstop, similar to the one you may remember that the EU proposed initially.
Yes.
I think we've actually reverted full scale back to what Theresa May negotiated in December 2017, the joint agreement. And that poses the question, what was the last 2 years actually all about? What was it for? If you look at the front of the Sunday Telegraph in Britain today, we have Jacob Rees-Mogg, leader of the House of Commons, essentially saying, there may be things we have to suck up this week. And this is the guy who militantly opposed even the most mild sort of concessions that Theresa May made. So I think it may
he won't concede too much, which at least is okay then.
That's true. And the big question, I think, and I think it's very pertinent in the case of the DUP stance, because Nigel Dodds, amongst others, is suggesting that they've still got deep, deep problems with this, is does Boris Johnson have the numbers in the House of Commons? And I'm very doubtful, in fact, that even if we get to a point towards the end of the week that he will be able to get this deal through the Commons. He may be able to bring back some of those 20-odd Tory MPs that he's lost. Mm. He probably won't be able to get the DUP on board. I doubt very much that he will get Labour on board. So, you know, there is as much uncertainty at the end of this week going into EU Council week as there has been at any point over the last 2 years.
Paul O'Brien, you're a former resident of government buildings. You probably at the time weren't allowed to speak as frankly as somebody has told John Drennan, which they believe that the DUP will eventually go along with the emerging Brexit deal anyway. Do you think that is the case, or do you think that there is still the prospect that Boris Johnson goes into the tunnel, gets some sort of deal which appears workable, and that it still gets torpedoed by those who are propping up his own government?
I think for Boris Johnson to be successful here, he's going to have to pull off a political spectacular. And I think there's a lot of doubt around the table whether or not he's got the team or the temperament to kind of pull this off. Like, he has an incredible amount of internal stakeholders to appease here, far more than the Irish side. And, you know, there's a real risk here at the end of all this process, just like with Theresa May's deal, after proposing and agreeing this agreement, the people most opposed to it are, in fact, the UK government.
Do you think that's the case? You think that Boris Johnson goes in there and actually negotiates something that even his own red lines are breached in?
I think so. You look at the front page of some of the UK papers today, and the UK Mail on Sunday has got, quoting Philip Hammond, the Tory rebel, saying even if he does get a deal, they still want to see an extension to Article 50. So he's
just a technical one, though, just to ratify and get through all the obligatories there, isn't it?
To get this across the line, I think they need to move quite quickly. You know, this is going to be before people and different parties he has to get across the line start wandering off in different directions again. And, you know, in the past few days, I honestly think that Dominic Cummings must be locked up in a room in Downing Street for there hasn't been
He's
kind
still
of vicious.
To get out of the suit.
Yeah.
Well, I did think it was remarkable, actually, that Dominic Cummings, having said what he is, you know, everyone reckons that he did say to the Spectator, that he was also in Cheshire on Thursday lunchtime and appears to have been, you know, sitting in for some of these salient conversations in which things suddenly got back on track. The aforementioned Jacob Rees-Mogg, by the way, mentioned this morning on Sky News that if we can deal with the abdication of a King Emperor within 24 hours, we can certainly deal with leaving the European Empire within 12 days. So at least he, who is responsible for the governance of business in the House of Commons, seems to think that it's possible to have a deal ratified next Saturday and to do all the legal mechanics to get them out by Halloween.
I'm loath to be absolutely committed on it, like listening back to your panel last week, and they were absolutely categorical that there wouldn't be a deal.
Yeah.
You know, and here we are 7 days later.
We're going to play that audio back to Kevin Doyle if this doesn't work out.
So I'm a definite maybe, you know,
okay.
But I would think that the hurdles and skill, political skill need to be exercised by Boris Johnson this week is going to be of a top tier order, and we haven't seen much evidence of that to date.
Sheila Riley, what do you make of where we think stand, or what jumps out at you from the coverage this morning?
I wouldn't share John and Paul's pessimism, to be honest, but I would be a bit more optimistic about where we potentially could go. I think it's some really significant breakthrough this week. It was a major achievement, really, on both behalves. Whether or not it'll turn out to kind of just fall in the sand and disappear, yeah, I don't know. It obviously remains, but I think in terms of the dreaded word, the optics of the whole thing, to come out after allegedly 90 minutes and to have some sort of a breakthrough was far more than anybody had anticipated. I think it's naive to think that just happened over the 90 minute period between talks between the two of them there. I'd say there was
been some duplicity going on behind the scenes.
Yeah, there has to have been a lot more talk happening in the background, and even Tim Shipman kind of alludes to it as well in his piece in the Times today. You know, he's talking about Savage Javid rang Pascal Donoghue during the week, a 30-minute call, you know, kind of softened the ground.
Well, it makes Pascal
Donoghue
have half an hour spare to take a phone call during the week, to be totally honest.
But, you know, so I think there was a lot more work done to get to this point that we're here now. It's far better situation than we thought we would have been even 4 or 5 days ago. Like, a lot of people were just looking at that meeting on Thursday as literally a kind of a, you know, tick box exercise, you know, here that we'll all come out and, you know, shrug our shoulders and say, well, we tried, you know, we made one last ditch effort and here we are. But we didn't. And I think that Rees-Mogg's interjection today and his piece in the Telegraph is a major piece in my mind, you know, that it shows that the ERG are willing to kind of row in behind Boris, whatever kind of a deal he can hatch out. And that's a really significant development. I mean, he says here in the Telegraph, as a lever, Boris can be trusted. Now, you know, whatever your take on that
there,
might
perhaps
be, you know, I wouldn't say Boris is a lever. But, you know, you have to say that that in itself is a very significant development for him to be even saying that he's going to try and bring the ERG with him. And whether there'll be enough of the Labour vote to go with Johnson to get this over the line, really, you know, who knows? It just totally remains to be seen.
Yeah,
well, we're in a far better place than we thought we would
No,
be.
That's absolutely the case. I think people are much more sunny about it this weekend than certainly Kevin Doyle sitting in the studio last week was very pessimistic about pulling it all together. And I have to be perfectly blunt, I shared that pessimism too. One point about that is that I wonder now whether, because Jacob Rees-Mogg is in government, whether he is still as much of a bellwether of the ERG as he used to be, that there was a point where if he said no while he was on the backbenchers, he would bring 60 votes with him. And I don't know whether he has necessarily the same sway because he's inside the gates these days. Open question to any of the three of you want to take this. Given that Leo Varadkar went into the room on Thursday and came out saying he believes that there is a pathway to a deal, that clearly he thought that whatever was said to him inside the room is workable, will it be something of an embarrassment to Leo Varadkar if we come out of the tunnel this evening or tomorrow morning or tomorrow lunchtime and it turns out that what Britain was proposing actually wasn't acceptable to the rest of the EU?
No, I don't think so. Let's remember that the Irish position hasn't changed one iota since December 2017. Neither has the EU position. There was nothing that came out of Thursday that indicated to me that there was significant movement. If there was any change there, it was clearly on the British side. So I don't think so. At the end of the day, if this doesn't actually work next week, he can say, look, in all good faith, we tried. But it simply wasn't possible to align the red line set by the British government in the kind of way that they framed
it. So is that to say that it would fall then on technical reasons and not for actual, like, principled reasons?
Yeah, I mean, if we had been playing the same games as the British side had in recent weeks, in recent months, then I think your argument, you know, might well be a tenable one. Mm. But we haven't. I mean, the Irish government has been incredibly restrained throughout all of this, even where there was extreme provocation earlier in the week. So, you know, if we had been playing the kind of games that Dominic Cummings and his people had been playing, I think that charge might be justified. But, you know, whatever happens now, I think, you know, most people accept that this was always out of our hands to some degree. It depended on whether the British government being able to align whatever was being proposed with the red lines that they set in the Lancaster House speech that Mrs. May gave in January 2017.
I think it was interesting though that on Friday that Donald Tusk was still sounding that sort of cautious note and suggesting that there wasn't any guarantee that the tunnel would emerge with a successful agreement. I suppose, Paul, to one degree, Leo Varadkar and the European side have to go into the tunnel in good faith, because they do have to at least, you know, even give it a bash. Even the slightest sliver of a deal has to be pursued. But you'd have to say that from the general tone of things, that this isn't just a kind of a housekeeping cover your backside entry into the tunnel, that there does seem here to be, you know, at least the genuine prospect that they do feel like something can be stabbed out of this.
They are taking this process seriously, and, you know, talking to some former colleagues inside of government have been very tight-lipped about this process and about the nature of the deal. Which kind of tells you two things. Number one, that they're taking it very seriously. And number two, they want to see it succeed and they don't want it to jeopardise it. And they are aware of the, you know, the pantomime villain image of Leo Varadkar that's kind of built up in some of the Tory media in the UK. And they really don't want to play up to that at all. And they really wanted to be as helpful as possible, I think, during the week. And certainly if I was back in government buildings looking at the events of Monday and the briefing to the Spectator and the Dominic Cummings type mantra coming out, I'd have been quite worried going into kind of private talks on Thursday. This was all part of some blame game strategy out of 10 Downing Street. But I think
maybe you just need to look at the whites of their eyes and convince them that you aren't the pantomime baddie that they've all been making you out to be.
Yeah, and I know. And going into a private meeting, you know, Prime Minister to Taoiseach, you know, with no officials present at all, it was a real sign that they really wanted to hammer something out, you know. And, you know, that always gives officials pause for thought that they go in and sort these out things themselves. Because there's always a risk of misunderstanding or, you know, deliberate spinning afterwards. But it seems like this is a very serious proposal that's gone into the European tunnel.
Well, I suppose the fact that they've been so discreet as well adds to this, you know, as you mentioned, the sense of paranoia sometimes that if the DUP see any sign of triumphalism on the Irish side, that then they'll get their backs up. And it's in some ways, it's regrettable that things have become seen as a zero sum game, that anything that is a win for one side is seen as a loss for the other. What do you make, though, of the front page of the Sunday Times and John Mooney suggesting that there would be some degree of a loyalist uprising? And this isn't even, you know, a constitutional threat to Northern Ireland. This is just about what sort of commercial terms in which they operate.
It was interesting. If you talk to officials inside of government who had like long-term responsibility for kind of managing that relationship with Northern Ireland, they would tell you that UK government always viewed Northern Ireland through the prism of security up to quite recently. You know, it was all about maintaining the peace. It was all about maintaining the peace process and maintaining that very delicate balance in Northern Ireland. And I think it's fair to say the UK government has taken its eye off the ball in the past number of years of Brexit and everything else. And I think you've seen some speculation in the UK media today that a large motivation for Boris's willingness to kind of compromise and try and strike a deal out is his fear of what will happen in Northern Ireland in the event of a no-deal Brexit. But it just goes to show you that the delicate balance in Northern Ireland is at risk throughout all of this process. And there's very live and very dangerous risk to manage.
Sheila, that must be a concern to you as someone who is in the border region.
Absolutely, it is, of course. Yeah, and I think this is very timely piece by Mooney, because it highlights the fact that the loyalists, you know, to use that phrase, they haven't gone away, you know, and the reality that is that they are there too, watching very closely. And I think that's kind of quoted in the piece. And the line, the subhead cuts it off, but the full line there, I was talking to someone who said that we'll see how hard the border is if the bombs start going off in Limerick, you know, and that is the reality in terms of what they're talking about, and that the security services in the north are gathering intelligence on the intentions of all paramilitary groups, and that this is definitely coming under their radar. Now, I read in some of the other papers that they believed that they had the UVF kind of locked down, or that they were on side, if you like, in relation to where the thing was going. But in reality, you never would. And there's a real kind of daunting image somewhere. I think it's in the Times today. It really, really struck me. It's taken in East Belfast, and it's a couple kind of pushing a pram under one of the murals, you know, some of the loyalist murals and that. And it's just kind of, you just got this sense of looking at it, of this idea that it, you know, it hasn't gone away. It's still such a huge burden on those communities, and they're still carrying all of that, even though we're kind of happily marching along in a different path, if you like. And that there's far too many forces out there really, really willing just to pull it all back as quickly as they could, you know, and to take everything, all the hard won piece, take it from under them all. And then there's also a number of pieces about kind of the reality of organised crime. And how they could kind of organise criminals, if you like, could benefit from any sort of a shift in relation to, particularly in relation to a no deal. And I mean, that's been said a number of times, but it can't be underestimated. All these outside agents, if you like, they're happily waiting for the opportunity that this whole scenario kind of presents them as far as they're concerned.
It is an absolute shame, by the way, that you mentioned the Sunday Times subhead, and the subhead is we'll see how hard the border is when the bombs start going off. It's a shame that the words in Limerick are cut off, because they're not talking about Ulster violence. They're talking about taking the campaign.
You could argue that that's overstated, because bombs never went off during the Troubles in Limerick.
But they did go off in Dublin and Monaghan,
And actually, to support the kind of thrust of the piece, a month ago I was in Slovenia at a conference, and there was a Brexit panel, and Monica McWilliams, formerly of the Women's Coalition, stood up from the audience, and she said she was in touch with paramilitary leaders on all sides, and she was very clear about the risks involved, that they were literally waiting for the moment. But I think the key thing here will be the DUP, because if the DUP rose in behind a deal, I think it does. They then, the paramilitary groups just don't have the cover necessary within Protestant and loyalist communities to be able to.
A DUP objection would give them a certain legitimacy.
But if the DUP doesn't support the deal, then all bets are off, obviously.
Yeah, I think it would be very hard to see a clear-cut supporting message from the DUP for any deal. You know, in history of showing, they'll always try and find some sort of fudge or middle ground, try to have it in both ways going forward.
Yeah, trying to find some delicate choice of words that manages to express their articulation for their annoyance, but not giving fuel to any kind of loyalism will be interesting to see. Paul, you were like a dog with a bone coming in this morning, being like, hey, there was a budget 5 days ago. Why don't we talk about the budget? There's not much appetite in the papers to talk about the budget, though, is there?
Well, I suppose it's the last big act of this government, the last opportunity for the parties to set out their stalls in advance of the next general election, trying to find themselves. And, you know, it kind of gives a bit of flavour, maybe what kind of position the different parties are trying to adopt or into next election. And, you know, there's very little of that, actually, this time around.
Well, Fianna Fáil couldn't even publish a list of priorities, which was partly because the talks were still ongoing. And usually when you publish a list of priorities, it's because they're the things you've already got in.
Well, interestingly, as part of the conference supply agreement, Fianna Fáil have never done a pre-budget submission like they did previously in opposition. And I think there's a lot of frustration, I think, in Fine Gael over the years, because I led them to kind of speak outside both sides of their mouth maybe a little bit. And you saw Fine Gael hitting back this year, kind of tossing up all the kind of spending commitments up to about 4.3 billion or so, and kind of throwing it at them. And because they didn't have a pre-budget submission, they could fight back with words, but not with figures. And it kind of links back into, I suppose, some of the things in the papers today from the OECD warnings about corporation tax receipts, how we're going to account for that in the next few years as part of the budget, and whether or not parties will take responsible positions and not accounting for all that tax revenue from corporate tax receipts for the next few years. And if you look at some of the smaller parties as part of their pre-budget submissions this year, the Greens, Sinn Féin and Labour all did their pre-budget sums on the basis of a controlled Brexit. And that was before Thursday's developments came around. So that just shows you how optimistic they are with the budget figures. So there's lots to pick through, like a lot of the politics of the budget like this.
Sheila? I think there was deliberate kind of attempt sort of to play the whole thing down, if you like, as well. And that a lot of people, I'd say the government in particular, were relieved there wasn't a lot of drama out of it, and that it wasn't generating a lot of headlines. As Paul says, it's kind of this sense of sort of just preparing the ground for an election. One of the things that jumped out at me last weekend was I just thought how unedifying it was to see kind of the Independent Alliance and going and kind of claiming this, that and the other. And Fianna Fáil.
Walking into government buildings at 6 o'clock and then being amazed to discover that there was a news camera there to catch them live.
Can you believe that there was a news camera there at 6 o'clock in the evening? Isn't that absolutely shocking? I just thought that is just senseless political drama playing out this kind of parish pump politics, and I really kind of object to the notion that this is something that's unique to rural areas, because time and time again we've seen it's absolutely not. I won't be naming names, but you know that I just felt the whole thing was just that a part of it was completely and utterly unedifying. And then that really the reaction to it, kind of the whole drama from the budget, if there was any, was sort of taken, the whole oxygen was sucked out by what happened on Thursday. Then, I mean, that was just the reality of it, and people just kind of lost interest. But the piece on the front of the Sunday Business Post today is very important in what it highlights, as Paul's just mentioned there, you know, just the potential for what could happen if the OECD, you know, if, as they say, you know, that there will be plans kind of to pull back, to make those big corporations, make the big tech companies basically pay tax in the countries where the sales are, and that could potentially lead to a huge drop in revenue for us.
See, it might do, but then isn't the art of a lot of how these companies work is that the likes of Google and Facebook, they book all of their sales in Ireland anyway. So it might be a French client who is paying to advertise on Google, but they are corresponding with the Dublin office. So arguably Ireland is the place where a lot of those sales happen anyway.
Yeah, but the reality is, this is all coming under the spotlight, and I think we should get the sense and cop on to know that it's coming to an end one way or another, and we need to soften the blow for ourselves. And that's why Pascal is out today saying, you need these surpluses in order to build up the cushion for that fallout. I mean, there is logic in what he is saying there. You can understand it. And there is a huge dependence on that corporation tax. And can we actually sustain that in the future or go ahead relying on it? It doesn't make sense. You know, Ian Guider makes a really good point in the Sunday Business Post today as well. We are too reliant on that, and we haven't done enough in terms of reeling in spending in certain areas, particularly he highlights the spending in health over the years, and that we're continuing to kind of supplement health and not asking enough questions about all of the money that it's sucking up.
Yeah.
And I think that's a very, very important point, that we're just kind of going ahead with that there's not enough questions being asked of the different departments in relation to their spending.
What I think is remarkable is that one of the main themes of Pascal Donoghue's speech on Tuesday was that he says, this is the end. We're now going to get into sustainable management, and we're not going to allow it to run over, so that we're not going to have to put surplus tax revenues to cover spending in future. And yet this morning, in that page in the Sunday Business Post, he appears to be effectively saying, John, that in actual fact, if the corporation tax receipts were to disappear, that it's not the case that we will have our spending under control, and that we'll need to run positives for years to be able to cover it up.
Yeah, I think that goes to the heart of Pascal Donoghue's kind of stance as a genuinely conservative and prudent finance minister. I think actually in this case we can say thank God for Brexit, because in advance of a general election there's always the temptation for governments to offer, particularly of a right-wing variety, to offer tax cuts to the electorate. Mm. We don't need them. We actually need to address these real deficiencies in healthcare, in housing, and in so many other areas by spending more money.
That we've done that though,
has
he been covered by simply just saying that the money has to be put aside for Brexit help?
We haven't done it because the size of the deficits accruing after 08 was so big, but we haven't done it also because the government really wasn't committed to doing the kind of things I think that needed to be done. But just on the dangers that they're out there, I think Pascal is absolutely right to be pointing to the need to run surpluses. But the bigger dangers, I think, actually are about the potential for a global economic shock like 2008.
Yeah.
And it comes from the things that Trump has been doing with China. It comes also from the renewed kind of financialization of the world after 2008, the ripping up of many of the regulations that were put in place by the Obama administration in the US. There's a lot of danger there. And we go into that kind of event with $200 billion worth of debt and in a very, very poor position in relative terms. It gets much worse, obviously, if we get a bad Brexit.
It kind of sounds very much like Italy at the start of this decade. Actually, a lot of those concerns that it would be very vulnerable because of the mountain of debt that's already there, no matter how well you're doing on a day-to-day basis, that you're carrying this huge load of debt, which suddenly becomes very expensive to deal with.
Well, of course, we're lucky in the sense that the cost of maintaining that debt has actually reduced very significantly. And there is an argument, and it was there in the run-up to the budget, that we should actually be borrowing more to finance the Sláintecare program, for example. And that was one of the good elements of the budget, I thought, this time, that, and Sheila's absolutely right, wherever healthcare is concerned in the budget, it's usually these massive deficits that are unexplained. Mm. But here, where you're concretely spending money on these priorities identified in the Sláintecare report, that's very welcome and we need more of that.
So the few pieces in the papers today about the electoral attitude of all of this, Philip Ryan has a piece in the Sunday Independent about Simon Harris warning of the defeatist attitude within the Fine Gael ranks. There's an editorial in the Sunday Times about how a Brexit deal would give both sides a green light for an election, both sides of course being the British and Irish governments. Justine McCarthy has a piece on the front page of the Sunday Times about how the likes of Owen Murphy and Simon Harris are encouraging Leo Varadkar to go to the country if there is a deal. Paul O'Brien, you once upon a time had the ear of a Taoiseach. If that Taoiseach was still in power now, would you be encouraging him to go for a deal on the back of the Brexit hurrah that no one ever thought would come?
I'll give you a straight answer and I'll say yes, that if all things being equal and get a deal across the line and get it all ratified and everything else, and if the opportunity was there, looking at election choice between November and February, You'd have to go with November. And
the partly the lessons of 2015 when he didn't go with November and then February didn't work out too well.
I think that weighs on people as well. Like, there's no such thing as a budget bounce anymore. It hasn't been for 10 years in politics. Like, people don't reward politicians for kind of spending their money anymore like they did back in during the boom years. And with this budget done, nothing's going to change between now and the springtime. And so you see Micheál Martin talking about trying to keep this government to keep going into the new year, because he knows politically, you know, hospital trolleys always spike, you know, the first week in January. We could be looking into, you know, flooding season and storms again, and all the benefits of budget is kind of banked. And if there is a successful Brexit deal, take that positivity and, you know, frame the election around that rather than around anything else.
But if you try to frame an election around a Brexit deal, is there not a danger that after 3 days it becomes about all the other things? That, you know, we saw the British general election two Absolutely. Years ago, which was supposed to be framed around Brexit and give me a mandate to deliver Brexit. And actually within a couple of days people went, well, this is also our opportunity to cast our verdict on austerity and the state of the health service and the state of housing and public services and everything else. Absolutely, so very quickly, yeah. even if you try to go in on the basis of a Brexit bounce, that it doesn't end up being delivered that way.
Momentum is everything in election campaigns, so getting off to a good start is vital, as we know. And, you know, an election campaign always quickly, as you say, turns into a what's your offering for the future? What's your vision for the future? And, you know, people argue now, go, if he goes in November, there'll be, you know, debates about shouldn't he have not gone. All that gets resolved quite quickly, and it quickly turns on to what are you offering for the next 5 years? What's your vision for the next 5 years?
Which is my point, that if you go in there, and I take your point about wanting to get off on the right foot, but that very quickly you've delivered Brexit when you go, well, thanks very much, but what do I get now?
Well, I think all the parties are ready for this election. They have been ready ever since the whole Francis Fitzgerald episode over a year ago.
Yes,
so like the manifestos are done.
November 2017.
Candidates are selected, and nothing's going to change between November and February. So they're still going to have their platform ready. All that happens is they lose the shine of any potential Brexit deal, which I'm still pessimistic, by the way.
Yeah, see, that's the issue, though, isn't it? Because we don't know what Brexit, what that Brexit deal is going to deliver. And there is a huge risk in terms of putting your eggs in that basket and running on an election, heading for an election on that basis. You know, I just think, were they to go for an election, this, to my mind, is just total echo chamber stuff they need to cop on.
Well, it might well be, and it's entirely a hypothetical thing when you don't know if there's a deal or not.
Yeah, absolutely. And as well as that, I think you would be completely underestimating the lack of appetite out there for a general election in the face of Brexit, and that it would look reckless to be going ahead with this, because the reality is Brexit is not going to be resolved by November, no matter what happens.
There's
going to be a lot of play
for the government that if they wait, there are 4 by-elections scheduled for the end of November.
That is a huge risk.
You have the negative momentum of losing three out of four,
and you then have a problem with your brand if you wait until February. So there is an argument, and I see it, that Paul is making. But, you know, the reality also is about what the numbers actually produce at the end of that election. It's likely, I think, to be just an inversion of what we have now. So that Fianna Fáil is the largest party, and they either go with a rainbow coalition if they manage to secure that via the numbers, or it's another confidence and supply regime in reverse.
Well, given that
vacuum, we end up in exactly the same place.
And we all remember that it took 10 weeks to form the last government, and albeit now that the path is sort of formed, so maybe it wouldn't take quite as long next time. But this is the reason why I don't think it would happen. And Paul, I'd be interested to get your points on this before we go to an ad break. If you dissolve before Christmas and you don't have something cohesive again this side of Christmas, you don't legislate for a finance bill, you don't legislate for a social welfare bill. I know there's not as many changes in them because of the nature of this year's budget, but that if you haven't legislated for those things, you haven't passed an Appropriations Act, which means spending for this year suddenly looks very dicey. You have a government effectively operating at half power because there are no legislated for budgets for next year. But also, if there's no dole before Christmas, then you can't pass supplementary estimates for health and justice and housing. And you have the prospect where the health sector, possibly, you know, Simon Harris wanting to get the election out of the way before Christmas because he knows there might be a trolley spike coming in January. But you have a health sector that quite legitimately literally runs out of money in the second week of December. And a justice budget that runs out in Christmas week, so that there are no guards on the roads between Christmas and New Year. Like, that's kind of the dystopian byproduct of what happens if you don't have a functioning doll by Christmas.
I mean, they can take care of these things quite quickly if they want to. I mean, the nature of the budget, as you said, like a lot of the tax cuts, the limited ones that were there, and social welfare increases are all timed for next September anyway. Like the appropriations, I'm just getting very technical now, but like the appropriations in 2016 didn't happen until April or May because there was the like the 3 month bung for government negotiations, which I remember well and aged me horribly at the time. But so these things can be taken care of like that. It wouldn't be a case where that dystopian vision.
But for the supplementary estimates, though, where you need to, the Dáil needs to ratify extra spending for the health sector for this year, or else the HSE literally runs out of cash in the middle of December, surely that would be a concern. Because you need to have a functioning Dáil to pass those.
As I said, I'm not positive that a Brexit deal is going to happen. All things being equal, if it does happen, you can find ways to take care of these things and rush things through before
the Jacob Rees-Mogg attitude there of, you know, if we can deal with the abdication of a king emperor in one day, we can certainly pass a supplementary estimate for health in 3 or 4.
I'm having my cake and eating it, yeah.
Okay. John, we wanted to talk to you about what exactly is going on, not quite in the Middle East, but on the European side of the Middle East, particularly with regard to the knock-on effect of Trump's effective withdrawal of support for the Kurds and everything that's now going on there in the wake of that. The Kurds are having a really, really desperate time of it in the wake of that decision.
Not for the first time in recent decades. The Kurds always seem to be the victims of new phases of geopolitics in the Middle East. You may remember after the first Gulf War in 1991, they were essentially abandoned by the United States. But I think what's really going on here is opaque, it's murky, and a lot of this is to do, I think, with Erdogan, the Turkish president, rather than Trump. And if you look at the way he has behaved over the last decade or so in regard to Syria, he's consciously always trying to make this link between the Kurds outside of Turkey and his Kurds in southern Turkey. He actually destroyed the peace process with the Kurds, which was actually working very well. He did it absolutely deliberately for electoral reasons to support and burnish his own base in Turkey. And now I think he's doing this kind of equivalence thing, saying that the YPG, the Kurdish group in Syria, is exactly equivalent to our terrorists. And he's able to, I think, surf the wave of sympathy for Turkey because Turkey is obviously
It's all about this kind of culture of othering the Kurds, that they're somehow kind of not really his people, that they're some sort of, you know, almost like a sub-race or sub-category of people.
Exactly. And so there's a consistency, if you like, in Erdogan's point of view. What's changed is that Trump has essentially given him the green light to go deep into Turkey and to engage in ethnic cleansing and to, I suppose, what he wants to do is to shore up his southern base to make it easier to control the south of Turkey, as he wants to do.
Given that the Kurds have so faithfully taken the, inverted commas, Western line on so many of the conflicts that are going on there, and they seem to always be the ones that get armed by Western governments to fight the wars that the West doesn't want to fight, one would think that in the grand scheme of things, it would almost make sense for there to be a proper Kurdish state that takes some of the territory from Turkey, from Iraq, from Syria, and that you would therefore have a Kurdistan, which could basically be in what we used to think of as a satellite government, where America could use it as a proxy to fight all of its wars, rather than having this kind of regionalized, non-codified state where we have these loosely armed militias.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the problem is the Kurdish population is spread out through different countries in the region, not just in Turkey and in Syria, but in Iraq and in Iran. So how do you carve out a Kurdish state? Actually, there was one carved out of Iraq as Iraq was falling apart in 2005.
Yeah, they got an autonomous region. Yeah,
and it established a kind of relative stability there. But, you know, for Erdogan, the Kurds will always be the enemy. And I don't think anything will satisfy him unless he's able to establish this kind of buffer zone to the south of Turkey. And I think that's what this week was all about. And we're going to see more of that in the weeks to come.
Yeah, I mean, if you talk to Americans, like, it doesn't really feature in Irish public debate at all, issues to do with national security, but they take it incredibly seriously in American politics.
Sure.
And, you know, I think if this narrative holds and if there is any developments about, you know, the Kurds abandoning ISIS prisons and releasing those ISIS fighters back into the wild again, that makes Republicans very, very nervous. And you see very strong comments from Lindsey Graham in the past week on this topic as well. And Republicans can tolerate a lot of Trump's issues, but if they start to appear weak on national security, I think there could be a weak underbelly for Trump on this.
Knowing that weak underbelly and given the immediate discomfort that there was from a lot of Republicans when Trump announced what he was doing and basically leaving the Kurds once again out to dry, then what I suppose is Trump's ultimate goal? Is it, as Sheila was suggesting off air, is it basically just a cover or a distraction to sort of take people away from the impeachment train, or is there a broader logic behind what he's doing?
You're asking me what drives Donald Trump's logic. I literally...
Well, you've been in the room with him. You've sat through some of those meetings.
And you know, Donald Trump, I think, just you know, like a weather vane, bashes off things and spins around the whole time. I'm not sure if there's any particular ideologically driving him at all. There's no ideology driving him.
Strangely, I think there is a kind of coherence about his approach to foreign policy, unlike lots of other areas.
And it's not really our business. Just get out of there.
Let's stop fighting other people's wars. And number two, there is this kind of mercenary approach, which he invoked again this week, actually yesterday, when he said, well, the Saudis now have agreed to pay us for X and Y, and that's what we need to do. He almost thinks about everything.
So basically they're hiring out the army now.
If you look at his comments on Ukraine, for example, he's saying, well, the European Union has deserted Ukraine, and the EU has actually given Ukraine vastly more than the United States has in recent times. So everything is kind of transactional with Trump. But I think if you step away from the insanity of the day-to-day stuff, you actually see a more or less coherent kind of worldview, which is we have to get out of the Middle East and of other areas similar to it because it's costing us far too much, it's attritional, and it's actually against the United States' long-term interests.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And I think Paul's point as well in terms of the idea of releasing that the potential that the ISIS kind of fighters could be released, that the Kurdish have been protecting them, the security guards have been protecting these prisons, and the reality is now their home base is getting bombed and they want to obviously go home and protect their own families. And this is alluded to in some of the coverage today, I think in the Times in particular. And you just had this notion of that they're down, say, in the camp like Al Hol, you know, kind of protecting 70,000, I think, are in that camp. Yet the reality is all hell is breaking loose on their home bases. I mean, needless to say, they want to leave. And if one goes, there's this sense that they're just going to, all these guards are going to go. And then who's going to protect these ISIS fighters?
And there's already lots of evidence that some of them are ISIS has regrouped and has become a stronger force than it was even months ago. And we've seen in Iraq and Syria over the last 30 years, these different iterations of Islamist terrorism. ISIS was just the latest of them, following on from Al-Qaeda in Iraq and others. So there's lots of evidence to suggest that what they have done this week is actually a gift to terrorist organisations.
That's what I was going to say. It's just going to totally revive ISIS or some of those organisations. That's the reality of it. Trump isn't going to care about the humanitarian crisis. Although I do think the social media element of this type of a war, you know, it's totally different when, you know, not to be too crude, but when, you know, the videos of dead children start to emerge. I mean, that's just the reality of it. That might kind of colour how quickly there is some action in terms of this. But I think the big thing is going to be the potential surge, or not potential, the realistic surge of ISIS and the potential threat that could bring back to America. And that's when it's going to become a reality for him.
On the topic of resurgence of ISIS, something that which might strike a little bit closer to home, because I accept that some people might think this is all a little bit abstract, particularly as Paul said, that we don't tend to talk too much about national security. But Norma Costello, who has been doing a lot of the work in the Irish Mail on Sunday and the Sunday Times about the fate of Lisa Smith, the former Defence Forces member who suddenly went to travel to ISIS to take part in that caliphate. She's been tweeting this morning that sources have told her that the Ayn Issa refugee camp, which is where Lisa Smith has been based, and also the family of the naturalised citizen Alexander Bekmirzaev, who was the former Belarusian who was naturalised in Ireland and then moved onwards. She says this morning that that refugee camp has been bombed and that some of the ISIS families that were based there have escaped, which does raise, I don't want to get too far ahead or to speculate too much, but it does raise the question that we may no longer know exactly where Lisa Smith is or exactly what's going on there, which I'd imagine, John, will probably give this whole discussion a much more domestic tinge, so to speak.
Yeah, I think it's guaranteed to provide coverage in the days and weeks to come. Certainly, when the story of Lisa Smith first emerged, I was kind of sympathetic. But then in more recent weeks, when we've heard more about her and, you know, why she was motivated to go to Syria in the first place, I think that colored that kind of original sympathy very significantly. And the question is, how many other people are there? There's some evidence to suggest that Ireland has been disproportionately represented in terms of the number of young fighters that left here to fight in Syria. And the problem is, we really don't know enough about them, about whether they're dead or alive. We do know about Lisa Smith, but there could be scores of other people in that same category. And the question then becomes, what happens to them if they emerge and want to come back home?
Yeah, I thought it was very interesting to hear here, Declan Power, who was talking to Pat Kenny. He's a regular panelist on this show, but he was talking to Pat Kenny earlier this week, and he said the window for getting Lisa Smith out of there had probably now closed with everything that's going on, and that certainly now seems to be something that's breaking fruit. We're going to have to leave it there, guys, because we're completely out of time. Regrettably, we're not going to get to talk about the War of the Wags, but I promise we might do that off air and maybe podcast it later on, who knows. In the meantime, thank you all for coming in this morning. John O'Brien, Professor of European Politics at Bnuth University, Sheila Riley, who's the Head of News at Iconic News, or Head of Digital rather at Iconic News, and Paul O'Brien, Head of Public Affairs at Drury. Thank you all very much for joining me this morning.